Hi, I'm Kathy Maranti, and this is Inspiration for Life Guidepost, June, July, 2024. Let's start with The Power of Forgiveness, written by Ricky Diston, Greenbrier, Arkansas. What you wish for. She never wanted to see her abusive father again. Am I speaking to Ricky Diston? Yes, I said into the phone. My voice was wary. I didn't have time for telemarketers. My husband Denny and I care for our adult son, who is disabled. Denny's mother also lived with us. Denny is a small-town pastor. Our plate is more than full. My name is Beverly, the woman on the phone said. I have your father here. He lived with our mother, but she's in hospice. What would you like us to do with your dad? There was an awkward silence. Oh, I didn't lack for ideas about what to do with my father. None of them were Christian. What I wanted to say was, do whatever you want with him, just leave me out of it. Instead, I asked her, where is he? With us here in Florida, said Beverly. He needs supervision. He has dementia. The doctor said something about Korsakoff syndrome, alcohol-induced brain damage. Your dad can't take care of himself. Where should we send him? I am sorry to hear about your mother, I managed to say. Let me talk to my husband. I'll call you back. One of my earliest memories of my father was of him hitting my mom and dragging her from a car by the hair. They were both heavy drinkers, and Mom was addicted to prescription pain pills. They fought constantly, and Mom gave as good as she got. Our house was a free-for-all, people wandering in and out, music blaring, wild parties. I was an only child. I learned how to keep a low profile and fend for myself. Dad never outright beat me, but he came close. He yelled, shoved, and slapped. I was terrified of him. Mom died in a mental institution when I was in my 20s. Dad was cheating on her the whole time. He walked away the day she died and never looked back. He didn't even bother to show up for her burial or pay for it. He managed to extend his cruelty to her past her death. Denny and I, with our young kids, were the only people there. I was so furious at my dad, I swore an oath. I never want to see you again until you die. Then, I want to be there and stand on your grave. It was a shocking thought, especially because I was a Christian by then. I was 16 when I stumbled on a Billy Graham crusade on TV. It was late at night, and Mom and Dad were passed out on the sofa behind me. I barely understood what the sermon was about, but I sensed it offered a way out of my misery. I gave my heart to Jesus, and things began to change. I met Denny when I was 18. He and his family were Christians, and Denny planned to be a pastor. I jumped at the chance to become a part of his family. They were the opposite of mine. Denny and I married, had kids, and Denny became pastor of a small church in Arkansas. Together, we built a life that I was determined to protect from the chaos of my childhood. I was glad I rarely heard from my dad. Why would I want him to be around my family? Not once did I miss him in my life. His absence was a blessing. I knew I couldn't hold on to those poisonous feelings. I went through the motions of forgiving him, in my mind at least. I never told him or did a single thing to repair our relationship. Mostly, I tried not to think about him at all. Best to keep the past in the past. Now, hanging up the phone, I couldn't help wondering whether this was God's way of saying, "Be careful what you wish for." I'd vowed to be there when Dad died. That wish was frighteningly close to coming true. I told Denny the news. I knew what he would say. He'd encourage me to do the right thing and find a placement for Dad at the VA facility, about 50 miles from us. Dad had served in the Korean War. Denny's response stunned me. "Well, we do have an extra room," he mused. "We're already taking care of my mom. Why not your dad?" "What?" Denny knew about my dad. I told him the stories. How could he propose something like that? "I'm not sure I have room," I stammered. "How old is your dad now?" Denny asked. "Almost 70, I said. "And he has dementia," Denny said. "He can't hurt you anymore, Ricky. My brother Ron can fly to Florida and pick him up. Your dad can stay with us until we get things lined up at the VA. Where else is he going to go?" He enveloped me in a hug. Much as I wished otherwise, I knew he was right. I waited for Dad's airplane at the airport, terrified. The plane touched down, and Denny held my hand as the passengers began to emerge. Suddenly, I saw him. That was my dad? The figure hobbling toward us was a stooped, disheveled, trembling old man. He looked disorientated, lost, frightened, like me. What got me was his hair. Dad had been a barber in his prime. No matter how much he drank, he always looked put together. Now his hair was stringy and wild. He looked like he was a man ravaged by a lifetime of alcoholism. The following days were a jumble. Dad needed clothes. He needed to eat. He needed a haircut and a doctor's appointment. The woman he lived with in Florida was named Esther. Things must have gotten bad there, especially as Esther declined. I wondered when Dad's last drink had been. He was sober when he got off the plane, and he had no access to alcohol at our house. He was like a different person, humble, quiet, grateful for every little courtesy. He didn't raise his voice once. He had about a 5-minute attention span and not a single memory of his past or my childhood. Maybe he grasped that I was his daughter. I couldn't tell. We had to keep an eye on him, but other than that, he wasn't much bother. I knew I needed to get the ball rolling with the VA, but each day, something came up and I put it off. Maybe I was trying to sort out my feelings. I veered between astonishment, gratitude for the change in him, and outrage that he had no memory of the damage he'd caused. God seemed to have given him the gift of freedom from his past, without bothering to ask my permission. A few times I worked myself up to let Dad have it. I planned to rehash all his offenses and demand an apology. I wanted him to acknowledge what he'd done and ask for forgiveness. Every time, I marched up to him only to be greeted by his smiling face and some kindly comment, such as, "You're such a good cook. This is delicious." He was complimenting me on his bowl of cornflakes, and he meant it. His innocence diffused my anger. We hired a home health aide, and pretty soon, I had to admit we weren't going to send him to the VA. He was just too dang nice. Often, he was the first one who noticed when I was stressed. "You all right, honey?" he'd ask. He forgot our grandchildren 5 minutes after they visited, but he was always delighted to see them. They loved him, too. He played with them and listened attentively to everything they said. They called him Papa, too. They even picked up a few colorful words from him, one bad habit he hadn't shed. Our 4-year-old granddaughter Kaylee was in a store with her mom and asked loudly, "Where in the hell did I leave my purse?" When her mom scolded her, she protested, "But Papa, too, says that." One particularly stressful day, I was sopping up the living room carpet after an air conditioner malfunctioned. "What you doing, hon?" Dad asked. I turned off the wet vac, explained my task, and got back to work. 10 minutes later, Dad tapped me on the shoulder. "What you doing, hon?" he asked. After he asked for the 5th time, my patience broke. I said, "I'm sucking water out of the carpet," I shouted. Dad shrank back, looking hurt and confused. He had no idea why I was mad. My heart softened. I apologized. I never thought I would apologize to him about anything. Finally, I admitted to myself that I would never get the closure I wanted. Dad was a different person now. In a way, he had become the person he might have been without the alcohol. I reconsidered aspects of his life. He had been a soldier at war. Perhaps he'd drunk to cope with PTSD. I didn't recall him telling many happy stories about his childhood. Had we both grown up in chaotic households? Dad's past didn't excuse his abuse, but I had a glimmer of how God might see him, a frightened soul haunted by inner demons. How could I resent God for freeing Dad from all that pain? Dad really liked Denny and looked up to him. He always ordered and enjoyed helping Denny with yard work. "Whoa, we worked hard today," he'd say, though he mostly offered encouragement from the porch. To my amazement, he even liked going to church. Dad had scorned church when I was younger. He thought my becoming Christian was ridiculous. One day, out of the blue, he said, "I'm so glad I live in a house where Jesus lives." I stared at him, speechless. But I couldn't deny that Dad was right. Jesus was here. He was hard at work on Dad and on me. Be careful what you wish for. I had wanted to see Dad suffer at the end of his life. Instead, God transformed my harsh promise into an unexpected opportunity to love. I couldn't turn down that remarkable blessing. Dad lived with us for 5 years before he had a massive stroke. "I love you," I said to him in the hospital, though he was no longer able to respond. I was with him when he died. Our whole family, his family, was there at his funeral. I had once imagined myself standing on his grave, celebrating a bitter victory. Now, I bowed my head and said, I'll miss you, Dad. Overcoming loneliness. In an age of social media, we're experiencing an epidemic of loneliness. Two friends who met online tell you how to grow an authentic connection. Keeping It Real, written by Amy Westerly, Midland, Texas, and Jess Johnston, Santa Barbara, California. Why is it so hard to make friends these days? Busy lives, digital distractions, lingering pandemic isolation, so much gets in the way of lasting friendship. Yet, friends matter more than ever. Last year, the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory about America's epidemic of loneliness, calling isolation a profound threat to our health and well-being. He urged Americans to reconnect with loved ones. Jesus called his disciple friends. The greatest love you can show is to give your life to your friends, he said. Perhaps the book of Proverbs says it best. A friend loves at all times. Amy Westerly and Jess Johnston know what it takes to make friends against the odds. The two writers met online and bonded over shared interests, including a passion for queso, forging a friendship that has survived hectic schedules, two long-distance moves, and a global pandemic. In their new book, Here For It, Amy and Jess share their wisdom about making, keeping, and deepening friendships. They draw on their own relationship and the experiences of 1.3 million followers in their popular Facebook community, Sister, I Am With You, a forum for all things friendship. Guideposts ask Amy and Jess to recommend four ways our readers can strengthen friendships in their own lives. Here's what they told us. 1. Be flexible, forgiving, and honest. Jess, not everyone has the same capacity for friendship, and people's capacity changes throughout life. Kids make friends easily because they have tons of free time. Grown-ups busy with work, kids, and errands? Not so much. Forgive friends when life gets in the way. Be honest when your capacity gets squeezed, but also look for friends who share your emotional needs and abilities. If you're a mom with small kids, it's a good bet another mom will not only get you intuitively, but have the same friendship expectations and amount to give as you. Amy, Jess and I met in an online writing group. We had a lot in common in ways that made it obvious our capacity for friendship was the same. We both had small kids. We both just moved. We both needed to build our confidence as writers. Most important, we're both women of faith, and we're open about that and pretty much everything else. There's a lot of fake on the internet. That's not us. The first time we met in person, Jess ordered a big hamburger and fries and made no apologies about enjoying it. Sometimes women make a show of nibbling on a salad. Not Jess or me. I love burgers, too. Somehow we got to talking about queso, the Tex-Mex melted cheese dip. You love queso? I said. Love it, said Jess. With American cheese? Of course. Maybe being grounded in God let us not obsess over appearing perfect. We quickly shared details about our lives, and that helped us know that we had the same capacity for friendship. We still do. 2. Be a good listener. Jess, do you feel nervous meeting new people? Ever wonder what to say to strangers? Try listening. When you let someone else take the lead in a conversation, a burden lifts. Remember that the person you're talking to was created by God and is loved by God. What a privilege to talk to someone like that and to learn about their life. When in doubt, ask questions. Expressing interest in the everyday details of another person's life goes a long way. People love to be heard. Your interest signals that you believe someone matters. Remember when Amy and I first met in person? During that dinner, Amy asked our waitress how she was doing and complimented her work. By the end of the meal, we were all talking and laughing. I was amazed at how Amy's genuine interest in someone she just met turned a stranger into a friend. Amy, talking to someone new, I look for things in common, not so I can jump in and share about myself, but so I can ask better questions. Let's say I learn someone's a teacher. I have kids in school. I'll share a small detail about one of my kids' classes, then say, how are things in your class? asking questions works especially well with a quieter person. If you're one of those quiet people yourself, listening first gives you more material to respond to. I want to go back to what Jess said about our waitress. I asked her questions, but I also paid her compliments. Jess did the same thing for me in our writing group. One of the first things she said was, "I really like the way you write. That felt so good." Nobody objects to a compliment. Everyone loves to be heard. Start with those two things, and you can't go wrong. 3. Hang in there when things get hard. Jess, a good friend says, "I'm here for you when you fall apart." A really good friend means it. When people fall apart, they say things they regret. They're full of drama, and they focus way too much on themselves. A good friend is there for it all. Because remember, one day, he'll fall apart too. When my kids were little, that all-consuming toddler phase when parents feel especially alone, a line in a sermon one Sunday gave me an idea. If something in your life is lacking, the pastor said, plant seeds of generosity in that area. I was falling apart as a parent and way too busy. Who had time to be generous? I decided to try it anyway. My husband and I started inviting other young couples over for dinner. Our house got crazy with all those kids, but everyone had fun. And guess what? Those other parents were all falling apart and feeling lonely too. A seed of generosity to people who need one can blossom into friendships that bless you too. Amy, I'm the kind of person who makes friends easily, but finds a friendship hard to keep. I thought there was something wrong with me. Did I skip some essential life class on friendship? Gradually, I realized that no one is born great at friendship. Each friendship is in its own life class. You have to figure it out and do the work, which means hanging in there when people fall apart, or have less to give, or seem less invested. Maybe what you interpret as lack of interest is just awkwardness or lack of time. Remember that God is your first and best friend. God loves you and never gives up on you. And let's face it, none of us is as good a friend to God as He is to us. He loves us anyway. With God as your foundation, you can handle it when friends fall apart, or when they're too busy or drift away. Remain open, stay generous, be forgiving, pray. 4. Remember that everyone sees things differently. Jess, no one sees 2020 when it comes to friendship. We all have our own quirks, tastes, and stories. We all have our own brokenness. We have wounds that no one can see, maybe not even ourselves, and we take them into every relationship. Amy and I met right before the pandemic. During the first months of our friendship, we were excited to meet a fellow writer. Everything seemed to be moving in the right direction. Then, in early 2020, the world changed. There we were, both of us recent arrivals in the places we lived, trapped with small kids in the house, wondering if things would ever go back to normal. The only way for our friendship to survive was to remember that, though our lives are similar, we are different people with different backgrounds who react to stress in different ways. We fell back on the friendship skills we've already discussed. Lots of questions. What's happening where you are? How are you handling it? How much venting can you tolerate? Patient listening. Lower expectations during a crisis. Total honesty. No pretending. We had things figured out. Our friendship survived intact. Maybe even stronger. Amy. The biblical word for what we're talking about is grace, and maybe grace is the ultimate foundation of all successful friendships. Grace is the foundation of God's relationship with us. When it comes to God, I'm pretty sure any of us is a terrible friend. We ignore Him much of the time. We disregard His good advice. We prioritize ourselves and give God the emotional leftovers. God not only never gives up on us, but also does everything in His power to rescue us from our worst selves. He puts up with our faithlessness and patiently brings out our best. The key to finding and making friends turns out to be pretty simple. God shows us the way. Listen, ask questions, express interest in everyone, compliment people's achievements, be patient and understanding. Don't walk away when things get hard. Be honest about your own struggles. And don't pretend you're perfect. Offer grace. We hope that you find and sustain those treasured friendships that are one of God's greatest gifts. Guidepost Classics, Honor Thy Son. I was a Marine officer, a lifer, More so, I thought. Then came Patrick, written by Ray Kimbrell, Louisville, Texas. I'd been on plenty of marches in my time as a Marine, but never anything like this. My platoon today was undisciplined, stopping to kick at twigs, talking and laughing as we hiked through the woods, no one paying attention to the sound of rushing water ahead. Then again, I would expect that from a bunch of 10-year-olds. I was about as far from the battlefield as I could get, accompanying my son Patrick and his fifth-grade class on a 3-day field trip at Camp Klassen in the Arbuckle Mountains of southern Oklahoma. I looked down at Patrick sitting in the 3-wheel jogger I pushed in front of me. My son has cerebral palsy. 10 years ago, doctors didn't think someone with his brain damage would live, much less be hitting the trail with his classmates. Before Patrick, the biggest challenge I had was achieving my dream, becoming a Marine officer. My dad was a Navy man, and I knew I wanted to serve in the military. In college at the Citadel, I chose the Marines. To me, there was no greater honor than leading the most elite fighting force on Earth. First, I had to go through Officer Candidate School, or OCS, 2 courses, 6 weeks each, of the most grueling physical and mental tests I'd ever faced, including the confidence course. A race through 11 obstacles with names like Slide for Life and Jacob's Ladder. I scaled tall barriers and swung from monkey bars high above the ground. Our commanders urged us on. Nothing was beyond our capabilities, they said. In 10 years, I rose through the ranks, becoming company commander. I served in Operation Desert Storm, then led my man in Somalia. Our mission was humanitarian, give food to starving people, rebuild roads, and disarm the warring local factions. But we came under fire. When times got tough, I prayed. God always saw me through. At the end of my 6-month deployment cycle, I returned home to Camp Pendleton in California. I'd have 6 months to spend with my wife, Nancy, just in time for the birth of our first child. Nancy was a Marine, too. We planned to alternate deployments so we could raise our children and maintain our military commitments. I was convinced that being a career Marine, a lifer, wasn't just my plan, but God's plan, too. My knees buckled when I saw our son Patrick for the first time. I was love-struck. I tore myself away from the hospital around midnight, 2 days after his birth, to get some rest. The ringing phone jarred me awake at 4 a.m. Patrick was sick, meningitis. I rushed to the hospital. He'd gone into septic shock. We're taking him to the NICU in San Diego, the doctor said. He may not have long. The Cape Pendleton community rallied around us. The base chaplain baptized Patrick. I prayed harder than I had even under fire in Somalia. Patrick clung to life like a little warrior, and after a month in the hospital, he was discharged. The doctors couldn't give us a solid prognosis, but a sonogram showed anomalies. His motor skills and learning ability could be impaired, perhaps severely. We'd have to closely observe his behavior. At the base daycare center, we noticed differences. Other babies moved more, rolling over and lifting their heads. Patrick was often still and couldn't get his head up. Nancy set him in an exerciser and needed to put in a pillow to keep him upright. After 5 months, it was clear Patrick lagged behind his peers. I put my finger in his right hand, and he gripped it tight. But when I tried his left, Patrick's hand and arm hung limp. Nancy read up on the symptoms. Everything pointed to cerebral palsy. One afternoon, I tucked Patrick in his crib for a nap. I went to the window to lower the blinds. Outside, a group of Marines ran by in tight formation, getting ready for deployment. My time home was almost over, and the process had begun for my promotion to major, which would bring new responsibilities. It was my dream, but it wasn't possible anymore. Nancy had been medically discharged after suffering a mild stroke after Patrick's birth, and she couldn't care for him alone. I have to quit too, I thought. I turned back toward Patrick. He looked peaceful, already asleep. I was terrified. Get it together, Marine. After Iraq, Somalia, how could this shake me? But war I knew, raising a son with disabilities. I hope you have a plan, Lord, because I sure don't. We left Camp Pendleton, and Nancy and I found jobs in Texas, where her family is located. We worked opposite shifts so one of us could be there for Patrick. We settled into a routine. Nancy put Patrick to bed at a sitter's house and went to her night shift job at a snack food company while I got some rack time. I'd pick up Patrick in the morning, get him dressed, and spend the day with him. I took Patrick in his crib for his afternoon nap and went to my second shift job, managing the processing line at a hot dog plant. Nancy had the evening shift. Our time with him was exhausting. I needed to hold him the whole time he played, retrieve every toy he wanted. Other kids displayed some independence after a year, but Patrick couldn't do anything by himself. One night, before I dropped off in an exhausted sleep, I turned on the news and saw a report of Marines being deployed. That could have been me. I missed the camaraderie, the 170 men in my unit, all looking to me for answers. My life was all about Patrick now, and I didn't have any answers. Our neurologist finally diagnosed Patrick with cerebral palsy and entered him in early intervention therapy. Physical, occupational, and speech therapists came to our house. The stretching and balance exercises reminded me of the training I'd gone through at Marine OCS. For Patrick, they were just as grueling. The occupational therapist put a hairbrush in 14-month-old Patrick's hand, and I expected him just to hold it. Instead, he started brushing Nancy's hair. Patrick started speaking little by little, and after 3 years of intensive physical therapy, I watched him take his first, slow, unsteady steps with the aid of a walker. He still needed a wheelchair for longer distances, but he was standing on his own. We had two daughters, Katie and Nicole. We didn't hold back on family activities for Patrick. He loved our trips to the lake, where he'd sit in a tube while I towed him on our boat. He sang along with the girls to any song on the radio. When Patrick was six, we found a program that allowed him to be mainstreamed into some classes and activities. One day, I took Patrick with me to the supermarket. In the checkout line, I saw a little girl standing with her mom staring at him. "Why are you in a wheelchair?" the girl blurted. The mom's face turned red. "I'm so sorry," she said. "It's all right," I said. Patrick needed to learn to deal with situations like this. Let him answer. Patrick did, but he didn't stop there. "You want a ride?" he said. The two of them spun around the checkout area, laughing and squealing. If I were still in the Corps, I would have missed this. Then Patrick reached fifth grade. "Guess what?" he said after school one day. "I'm going to be in the talent show." He was still behind his peers academically and needed a walker for balance if he was on his feet for long. Had I given him too much confidence? I didn't want to set him up for failure. I thought about a song Patrick and I loved to sing together. "The Greatest" by Kenny Rogers, about a boy who dreams of being a baseball player. The song's message was perfect for Patrick. Be proud of what you can do. Could he sing it? Every day after school, I played the song and helped Patrick memorize the words. Nancy and I rehearsed his routine with him. The day of the show, he wheeled to center stage wearing a baseball cap, carrying a bat and ball. While he sang, he threw a ball in the air with his right hand, his bat across his lap. I waited for the end of the song, anxious. Patrick beamed and sang the last verse in a full, loud voice. "I am the greatest, that's a fact, but even I didn't know I could pitch like that." The auditorium erupted. Patrick came off stage and into my arms. I hugged him tight. I may not have been leading 170 men anymore, but I was leading the one who mattered most to me. He'd come to me for an answer, and he paid me back with love. That was better than any, "Sir, yes, sir." Now, on the trail at Camp Clayson, I ruffled Patrick's hair. We emerged from the woods and reached the water. I stopped cold. There was a dam holding back a lake. A rush of water fell 6 feet to the river below. The only way across was a row of round cement pillars spaced out along the edge of the falls. No way could I wheel Patrick across. "We didn't know there wasn't a bridge," his teacher apologized. I stared again at the pillars. They reminded me of something I'd seen a long time ago. The confidence course. "No one stays behind," I yelled. I hoisted Patrick onto my back. "Hold still," I said, stepping onto the first pillar. Halfway across, he started laughing. His laughter echoed across the lake, a sweeter sound than any I could have ever imagined. Maybe God did have a plan for me all along. The Marines were just a part of it, training for the most important duty of my life. being Patrick's father. That's all we have time for today. I've been reading from Inspiration for Life Guideposts, June-July 2024. I'm Kathy Maranti. Thanks for listening to Chris.